We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com. It's better
over here. After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/AcrossAmerica.
Up to four lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device, credit, service, ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
Hi, and welcome to this episode of the Pete George Experience. As you know, I'm Pete George, and today we're going to have a guest on the show, a great, great friend. I nearly call him a brother from another mother, and that's my great mate over in Ottawa, Canada, Don LaChance. Now, Don is a grief and loss specialist, and as you know, with the theme of the show, we talk a lot about mental health and how to get around a few things. So, welcome, Don.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you. I'm honored that you see it fit to help promote some of the things that we discuss as grief and loss specialists.
Yeah, it's like, as you know, I went through a rough patch Christmas this year. And if you want to hear that story, you can just go to petergeorge.com.au and the show will be there. It's called Sometimes You Have to Hit Rock Bottom. And I feel that's just true. You know, like there is a point if you can't see it, that you as an individual sometimes might have to hit rock bottom. And that's when you realize that you do need help. And I think that's the hardest thing for someone with mental health is to actually physically work out your need to get help.
Yeah. Even in the sentence structuring that you use, we always want to go and refer to mental health when really we should be talking about mental illness. Mental health is the destination that's comfortable to talk about. It's the place we find ourselves after we've hit rock bottom and we've reached out for help. The unfortunate part about that is so many people don't ever ask for help. They can't break through this stigma.
Yeah, and that's a real good point. You know, it is an illness, and the hard thing is, I think, for a lot of people that have that illness is that we get shy on the fact that it's a not seen illness. It's not a broken arm. It's not a cut on the face or anything like that. And it has so many facets to it that as a sufferer, you sort of don't understand yourself, and sometimes it takes someone to point that out. And that's the hard part for other people to understand and learn how to point that out to someone in a tactile way that's not going to push them away.
Yeah, I think often the secret to that, Pete, is for us to have the courage to go first, for us to stand up and talk about that discomfort, because that's the secret to creating the space for those who suffer to take their masks off, and in some instances, people will be connecting on a real level for the first time.
Yeah, and it was quite funny when we had a chat a couple of weeks ago, and it sort of dawned on me when I said, you know, it was all of a sudden, it was bang, I had the incident on Boxing Day, and then it was probably 2 days later I felt like a new person, and you said, well, you've cleared everything out of your system. It's sort of like hitting a reset button on a computer, or, you know, it was just this emotional draw away of everything, and I felt like, not straight away, but I felt like the old Pete once again. And that's, this is going to sound strange, but that was the fun part about the journey.
Yeah, well, it's the fun part because it's the introduction of hope.
Yeah, very true. You know, and the other things that I've learned through it is that as when we're born, we're a blank slate and we get taught everything, and not everything that we get taught helps everyone cope or have a coping mechanism that is free and open.
What a great place for us to really start this conversation. You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because it's one of the biggest challenges we face as human beings. Yeah. You know, that conditioning that we get subjected to, because when you begin to understand that we take in our belief systems from the people we loved and trusted most, and in most instances, that was mom and dad.
Yeah.
And as we move through life, we begin to realize, were they really equipped with any form of truth to be handing off to us? They were dealing with all of their own stuffs and had been conditioned the exact same way by their parents.
Yeah, and it comes back to the notion that as parents, it's a learning curve. You know, there's no TAFE course for being a parent or a college degree for being a parent. You just do it as best fit you can, and that's where we learn from. You know, as a child, we don't know yet the difference between right and wrong information. It's only when we become adult, but that's all ingrained in us at that point when we are an adult and we have our own belief system, as you said, that was brought onto us by our parents.
Absolutely. And here's a real challenge for us as parents. We end up parenting to extreme pendulum swings based on all of the things and the ways we were parented that we didn't like, or all of the things that we believe we didn't get. And we go to extremes on those fronts because there's no balance in our lives, right? Yeah. We've been conditioned. We've been taught by our parents. And there are some things that we really hated. You know, have you ever had anybody say, oh, you're just like your dad?
Many, many a time.
And how uncomfortable that was, because we look at... We're not looking at the good stuff. We're looking at, wow, I don't ever want to hear that again. If you really want to piss me off, you know, remind me of things like that.
Yeah, and to be honest now, I shudder when someone says to me, you're just like your dad, because to me now on the journey I've been on, my dad wasn't a brilliant individual. He was one thing at the home and another thing out in the open. And I had a talk with a former work colleague of Dad not long ago, and he did not want to hear the bad about Dad.
Yeah, but isn't that the case for all of us? You know, seriously, I think... And again, you know, we'll talk about the conditioning. We can get into that a little more.
Yep.
But... I think we show up more authentically in our homes because we truly believe we're surrounded by people who love us, and we can be that gritty, non-caring, self-centered person in the home because we're surrounded by people that we believe love us enough for us to show up that way and still be accepted. Whereas in outside, like, we're on our best behavior all the time. We want the world to see us one way, and so we act that way.
And that's the scary thing. And it took me a long time to understand that with Dad. And then, you know, like you were saying that you're like your dad. And when it all washed out, I wanted to be more like Mum. And that was the beauty of it. You know, like, we can never take away from a mother the caring and nurturing type with the overriding power of someone that is aggressive in the house. So yeah, it was a little bit fun, but
yeah, you know, and again, it's the balance on both fronts, right? Because, you know, in the process that we teach, when we walk people through like a relationship graph, you know, there are terms in there that we refer to as bedevilment and enshrinement. And we need to be mindful of that, because if we've grown up in really unbalanced homes where a father was abusive and aggressive and the mom was nurturing and caring, and that's where we ran to for safety. Yeah. You know, when we take a step back and we look at it, at the actual relationship, we need to be mindful that we don't lose sight of the fact that we're all humans. And this is going back to your original comment about us being clean slates and the conditioning that we're subjected to by our parents and, yep, and the things that happen on the emotional front to us that we're completely unprepared for.
Yeah. Cause a lot of people may not know, and it'll all be in the show notes and on the webpage about Don, and Don's journey's been not an easy one through life. And yeah, it's great that he's now in the position where he is helping others and you know, opening up. He can open me up like a can of worms, Don can. So,
but it's your willingness, Pete, like, and that's the beautiful thing, right? Because it isn't until we develop the courage to talk about the ugly things, the things we believe are ugly. And the hard part, let's go back to the clean slate thing as us growing up as kids and how we're conditioned to not ever deal with emotional angst, with any emotional pain. And I believe truly that that plays such a significant role in our mental health elements, but it's completely overlooked. Because, you know, I keep the six myths that we're conditioned by up by my doorway, and I point to them often while I'm on Zooms like this.
Yeah, I've got them in front of me on the second screen.
Well, do me a favor and read them out.
Okay, the six myths are, number one is don't feel bad. Number two is replace the loss. Number three is grieve alone. Number four is just give it time. Number five is be strong for others, and number six is keep busy.
Now let's look at those. If we look at don't feel bad, how often that happens, and I can give you some examples. We come home from school and mom and dad tell us we're moving.
Yeah.
What kind of dilemma is that for us as children? And, you know, this is something that really freaks a lot of people out when they begin to understand that what they're experiencing in that moment is loss, a very definite loss. Because as a child, all of a sudden, you're told that you're moving. You start thinking about the neighborhood you live in, all of your friends, the school you go to, and you tell mom or you try and tell dad, well, no, I don't want to move. I want to stay here. Like I'm with my friends. And what do they say to us? Well, dad's got a better job. We're moving into a nicer house. They don't acknowledge anything that we're feeling, anything that we're saying. Yeah. And silently they're telling us, well, don't feel bad.
It's
don't feel bad. We're moving into a nicer house. So here they are already. Myth one, don't feel bad. Two, we're moving into a nicer house. They're replacing the loss of the house that you're leaving.
Yep.
You're moving away from. Yep.
It's quite funny. Hang on, my chair's got a gas problem. Not me. The hamstrings are fine. It's quite funny when you talk about that, because I was 15 going on 16, and I grew up in a small town in Victoria. And that's what basically happened, you know. And since that day of moving, I've never really had a true friend other than you.
Wow, that's a statement and a half, Pete. Yeah. When you think about that, and look at the miles, the kilometers that separate us.
Yep.
Yet our hearts are knit so tightly together because of the relationship, because you've been transparent with me, because I've been transparent with you.
Yep.
There are no secrets. Like, we've had some heavy duty conversations.
Yeah.
And you know, we've talked about some difficult things.
Yeah. And you know, it's just one of those great things. And yeah, it's, you know, and then we said, you know, like, the replace the loss. That was verbatim what my parents told me at 15.
Yeah. Yeah. And think about this. Here's another perfect example for people who haven't moved. If they were in love with their childhood sweetheart and they show up at school, or they show up like in high school,
yep.
they show up and they're obviously sad. They're crying. They can't hold their emotions in, and their friends all gather around. What's wrong? What's wrong? Oh, Betty broke up with me, or Mark broke up with me. Oh, don't worry. There's plenty of fish in the sea. You'll find another girlfriend. You'll find another boyfriend. Right away, they're telling us, don't feel bad.
Yeah.
We're going to replace Mike with Bob.
Yeah.
And right away, they go to it.
Yeah. And then we get to the third one, which is grieve alone. You know, like, you know, it goes from the going to the home and saying, oh, well, you'll get over it, you know, and you go and sit yourself in the room because you just feel at an absolute loss because you lost all your mates.
Absolutely.
You lost
Here's another killer.
Yeah.
Once they've told you, look, dad's got a better job, we're moving into a nicer home, you'll make new friends.
That's the one.
They're not addressing any of the angst. But here's where it gets even layers deeper. Here's a cookie. Go watch TV.
Yep.
So we take the cookie. We go watch TV. We feel differently. Subconsciously, there's something going on here. I had the cookie. I'm not feeling the same angst. Like, it's there. I'm not better, but I feel different.
Yep.
Because I'm having this cookie and I'm distracted now by television. So we begin to learn to apply short-term energy-relieving behaviors, what we refer to as STIRBs.
Yeah.
And that develops into eating disorders. That develops into escapism into fantasy worlds. We go to our games. We go to our television. The instant we begin to feel any kind of emotional angst, we've been conditioned to not feel bad.
To
grieve alone.
And, like, if we step it up and we have a look at today's world, and I don't know if you follow Simon Sinek, who...
I love Simon Sinek.
And I listened today to his presentation he did to corporate world about millennials and how millennials are today is not their fault. They are not to blame for where they are and how they behave and what they think today, because that's how they were conditioned. And it was the phone or the iPad or whatever. And that's the dopamine for them. That ring, that ding, that acceptance by a friend or texting out to a group of friends and saying hi and waiting for that intense moment.
The acknowledgement.
And the acknowledgement. And... you know, back, you're a little bit younger than I am. So, you know, it was in front of the telly, or it was, you know, go and play in the backyard. There was always something there to replace and distract.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that get cloaked, you know, because we escape in different ways, you know. Mine was through sex. Mine was through pornography. Mine was through fantasy worlds. Mine was through a lot of that stuff, right? And we don't associate that to the emotional angst we're feeling, the instant we begin to feel any of that, we turn to the things that distract us.
Yeah.
Right away, we want to turn to the things that distract us. But those aren't comfortable things to talk about. We can't say to anybody, you know, we can, but we certainly don't feel like we can, because we're going to be judged. And shame is a powerful thing.
Yeah.
And I think more often than not, we want to refer to things that we're fearful of. You know, and we often dress shame-based emotions up as fear, because fear is publicly accepted. If I'm talking to you about something I'm fearful of, I've lost you in the conversation, seriously.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you don't care what I'm fearful of. You've gone yeah. off, and now you're conjuring up all the imagery and all the things that you're fearful of, and we're no longer in conversation. You're off doing your thing. I'm talking about my thing. But I'm not really talking about the issue.
Yeah.
If I peel a layer back, it's shame-based, but we're so conditioned not to talk about shameful things.
Yeah.
And that's, we dress it up as fear. Yeah.
And that's, you know, the more you hang around the positive people like the Simon Sinek's, and even... I know he swears a lot, but his message is very positive, and that's Gary Vaynerchuk.
Mm-hmm.
They drive positiveness to a new level and understand how to get there a lot better. And basically, when you listen to all they say, it's just, as you said, breaking back the layers. You know, we're onions, if you want to put it that way, and you've got to get to that center bit. The center bit is the root, and that's a lot of that is the cause when you get to that part of the onion.
Well, as a grief and loss specialist, one of the incredible things that occurs, and it occurs pretty much 100% of the time, when somebody reaches out to us for help, it's because of an incident that's occurred, and we refer to it as like the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back.
Yeah.
And we begin to educate the people who turn to us that, you know, let me take a step back. We're grief and loss specialists. The majority of people will associate emotional discomfort they describe as grief.
Yep.
When they lose somebody that they care about deeply. When we lose a loved one.
Yep.
And that's an impactful event that happens. Somebody dies and we grieve. But the same emotional turmoil shows up for all of the intangible loss. So when your parents decided to move and they didn't acknowledge anything, you were experiencing all of this form of loss that was taking place, and it shows up this way. We refer to them as intangible losses, and they show up as all of a sudden loss of safety. Yeah. So you're moving to a new area. You don't know it. You don't feel safe in it, but you can't express that because you don't know that's what you're experiencing. You've been conditioned True. Since birth to not feel bad, to grieve alone,
yep.
to replace the loss, to keep busy.
Yep.
The killer for me is to be strong for other people. How many times have you heard that? Suck it up, buttercup.
Yeah, yeah. And you it's, know? And I think it's more prevalent today. Like some of the statistics that we see around suicide here in Australia, it's phenomenal. You know, like a large majority of suicides here are men in their 35 to 45 age bracket, where there is a lot of change and upheaval in their lives, and they just get told, oh, well, you're a bloke, you can handle it, you can do this, you can do that, and you can, you know, be strong for your wife or suck it up and that just gets to them, and they get beyond the point of,
oh, yeah. Yeah. Like when you think about that, the intangible loss element there. Yep. Here are some examples of intangible loss. Loss of trust, yep. loss of safety, loss of self-worth, loss of dignity, loss of innocence. So people who've been abused,
Yep.
That loss of innocence, there's the intangible loss of trust, of safety, of dignity.
Yeah.
And, you know, we begin to experience that at deep, deep levels, but we can't talk about it. We don't know how. Yeah. And there are a few people to sit and hold safe space and go first, talk about their discomfort,
yeah,
that really clears the way for me to take my mask off and connect and say, wow, you know what? Me too.
Yeah, do you think a lot of that, when I was in the mental health unit at the hospital and the occupational therapist came in, and she took away the pain, because I got obsessed with the pain that I was going through with all the elements that I have. And once I realised again there was a lot to Peter George that had a lot of worth, then I knew what direction I wanted to go in again. And that came to a lot of freedom again, and it made me want to contact the people and, you know, that I hadn't contacted in a long time, and you were one of those.
Thank you, Pete.
And I just felt that the space was right to get back to who I am, what I believe in, and deep down you just want to help others.
You see, and in there, what was that ray of hope when you began to realize that you were more than the pain that you'd been living with, because we become consumed with it, right?
Yeah.
It's heavy, it's dark, and it drags us down into that place. And because of all of this ugly conditioning, you know, what's the knee-jerk reaction? I run into you on the street, haven't seen you in a while. Hey, Pete, how you doing?
Yeah.
What am I going to get in the way of a response?
Well, it depends what day you got me on, but it can be an array of things from I'm fine and I'm hurting.
Okay, stop right there. That's the exact word I was looking for. And yep, I want the audience to know that there's no setup here.
Yeah.
When Pete told me, if I ask, hey, Pete, how you doing? I'll get 9 times out of 10, you're going to get, oh, I'm fine. And fine for us is an acronym. Feelings inside, not expressed.
Yep. So true.
So when I ask somebody, hey, how are you doing? And they say, oh, I'm fine. Okay, let's deconstruct that a little bit. I'm going to ask you again, and I want an honest answer from you now. How are you?
Right.
That's uncomfortable for most people.
Yep.
Right? Because now they're connected to some of the things where, I'm not really fine.
Yeah.
But they don't know how to talk about it because it's uncomfortable.
And it's one of the things that we aren't taught, really. We're not taught to communicate in an open and honest fashion.
Not only are we not taught to communicate in an open, honest fashion, we're conditioned to run in the other direction by these myths from birth.
Yeah. And that's it, you know, like... When you break it down and you start to realise that what it's all about, like if you take, I don't want to go down this path, but if you take things like the news, politics, everyday life, it's just a conditioning for their next step. That's how I see it now, whereas before I was consumed with politics and everything like that. It's just like mum and dad, but in a different environment where, you know, go down this path with us and we'll look after you. Now, going back to Simon Sinek, and it was quite funny, I had Jane watch Simon Sinek, The Golden Circle, because it's quite good for salespeople to watch. And he's talking about Martin Luther King and how he got 250,000 people without TV or without advertising or anything that we have today. And he got it wasn't because I have a plan. It was because I believe. Mm-hmm. And if you listen to politicians today, it is, I have a plan. And they wonder why people won't follow. And that's another thing that sort of sparks me off, that, hey, these people like Simon and others, and Jordan Peterson's another one, know how to steer away from that. But as we've been taught from birth, we get steered down the channel of do as I say, not as I do. Basically, that's how I see it.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting, right? Because with the introduction of social media, the algorithms rule, you know, and you talk about the millennials who are waiting for that ding, who are waiting, you know, the dopamine rush, the acceptance, like I matter, you know, because of the connectivity on that front. And the division that we're experiencing in the world right now has never been as pronounced and never been as obvious to me. And I really believe it's because of the way the algorithms are set up. And, you know, way back I was studying Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich. And there's a quote in that book that changed the course of my life. And here's the quote: we find what we look for.
And that's very true.
Yeah. And here, you know, so I don't want to platform, you know, anything in regards to COVID. The world globally, we've all suffered from that.
Yeah.
And we've been forced into two camps. You're either in favor of the vaccination or you're not.
Yep.
And let's just look at it at that base value, right? And so the side of the coin that doesn't believe in vaxes are out looking for all the reasons why they should really believe that. And so the algorithms, what do? Oh, well, Don's looking for this, so I'm going to reinforce that. And they start introducing other people into your feed that have the same beliefs. And what happens to you? Oh, geez, like I must be on the right path because, oh, look at this person. They've been introduced and they think the same way I do. And that's good. And the flip side of the coin is doing the exact same thing. So your beliefs are being reinforced by an algorithm that isn't concerned about educating you, but more about really feeding you some of the things that you're looking for. And when we take a step back and we look at what's unfolded in the world, that's where the division comes in.
Yeah.
And it's undeniable and it's ugly.
And it is, you know, like Dana and I speak quite a bit about a few things. And when the vaccines come out, we just said, you know, in my case, like I've got respiratory problems, I've got everything like that. And I said, okay, well, I've got to minimize the risk. I'll go and talk to the doctor and see what they say. And that's when I started to see the nastiness of social media with that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think we've lost the desire to get an informed decision based on our own findings.
Well, again, you know, and I don't want to get off topic. I don't want to glorify the algorithms and social media because, you know, the whole purpose of this topic is for us to talk about mental health and more importantly, the stigma that surrounds mental illness that keeps us from talking about those things that will lead us on the journey to mental health. You know, it was just it's just a perfect example of how we feed ourselves the information and how we're being fed the information. So let's look at what happens cerebrally when we go out and we're reinforcing our belief systems. Our minds and our egos are here. Yet all of this discomfort and turmoil in our spirits, in our emotional self, are not being answered, and it's being amplified. And we no longer know who to trust. And you see, so there's the intangible loss of trust that comes into play, safety that comes into play. And we begin to spiral downhill. And because we've been so conditioned to grieve alone, we don't believe that we can talk to anybody about this because no one's going to understand. You know, my history with wanting to talk about things that are uncomfortable get bleeded out instantly. Yeah. You know, oh, don't feel bad. Oh, there's plenty of fish in the sea. Oh, just give it time. You'll be fine.
Yeah.
And it goes on. Be strong for your family.
Yep.
And, like, how cruel can you be to somebody who's suffering emotional pain to tell them to be strong? Don't feel what you're feeling. Be strong.
Yeah. And it's a statistic that shocked me, absolutely shocked me, when I was doing a bit of research on the last, I think it was the last show or the show before. In 2020, so in the height of COVID, there was 99 suicides of kids between the age of 5 and 17. How can young kids that get to that point? It just blew me away. I couldn't comprehend, because I know, like, I've been to that end just about. Like, I was close. But for a 5-year-old to know those steps to get there, I just thought to myself, God, where have we as a society gone wrong? And that's been the biggest wake up for me with, you know, like you were saying about social media and that. But, at a 5-year-old, it's not social media, I don't think. I think it's the media. The TV, when you're getting bombarded with the same thing day in, day out, day in, day out. And these poor, you know, little tykes that don't know life, and they've been conditioned like we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And then they hear about suicide, and then because that gets mentioned, and mental health and everything like that, it just sort of shocked me that these guys can get to that point.
despair is an ugly thing, and the more of us who stand up and talk about the discomfort that surrounds these topics, the freer people will become, because you know, I can't speak to a 5-year-old committing suicide, like completing suicide. Like, I just can't. There's no place in me to even understand that.
Yeah.
You know, how does a 5-year-old get to that place? Yet I know 50-year-olds who've never really left the 5-year-old mentality.
Yeah.
Because they're trapped, right? They've been conditioned all their lives. Lots. And they just... We're trapped as people, but here's the good news: there are ways through that. There are more and more things surfacing, and the more people stand up, the more people begin to talk about the discomfort, the more people begin to get involved, and realize that when they speak about this, they actually start to find freedom as opposed to deeper despair.
I think that's the word, I think. It's freedom.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely, it is. You know, because we begin to drop, like the shackles come off.
Yeah.
And conditioning is an ugly, ugly thing.
Yeah.
And you know, we want to figure everything out, and the real resistance is 13 inches lower. And that's the journey from here to our hearts, right? Yeah. 13 inches in the average human body, but a journey that most men and women will never take because it's daunting, and it's uncomfortable.
Yeah. And one of the aspects and with growing up and conditioning, like I play darts, you know, I play darts, but one of the fears for me and for a lot of people is scoring darts. And this is going to be a simple sort of like explanation. The fear that a lot of people have is being embarrassed about making a mistake and, you know, getting corrected. My fear of scoring darts is that every time the report card came home from school, I was belted by my father for being bad at maths. And it was anxiety at its peak. But now I could go up there and score. As you said, the shackles have come away on...
of shame.
Yeah.
Because when you think about that realistically, you know, we don't want to talk about it. We want to just hang the discomfort on our dad's violent behavior.
Yep.
Yet really, if you begin to peel back layers, what little Pete George was experiencing was loss of self-worth.
Yep.
I'm not worthy. But we don't want to look at that. We want to look at dad's anger. We want to look at dad's just abusive nature.
Yep.
You know, and we don't want to talk about how it really made us feel. Again, the ugly conditioning.
Yeah, and that's the thing. When you sent that through to me and I just looked at it and I've gone, yep, 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 yep. And just that I'll run through it again because I want people to understand this, because the people out there are just going to go, yes. Don't feel bad. Replace the loss. Grieve alone. Just give it time. Be strong for others and keep busy. Now, if you're Don and my age, Don's a little bit younger than me, as I keep on saying, but it's his hair that does it for him. And if you haven't got to 30, I'll put that down. If you haven't got to the age of 30 and not been thrown all of those lines, I'll go, hey.
Well, you know, you could just advance that age. And if you haven't heard all of that by the age of, and let's just make this easy for people, by the age of 15.
Yeah.
Because think about this. We've been conditioned with these things since birth, Peter.
That's very true. You know, like, you lose a race. What's the reaction? You know, like, one of the things that when I started popping the pills, and Jane was angry with me because of what happened during the day, but there was no hug from her. There was no, you'll be right. She just sat there. And it was when I realised that I made the mistake that we got going. But, you know, I always remember we talked afterwards and she said, I said, you'd never help me down the stairs. She says, I'm never going to. If you were going to hospital, you were going on, down the stairs on your own. You had to do it yourself. And I think that's why she's such a special part to me. You know, like that she's a very open person herself, but then again, she's also very withdrawn at the same time. And yeah, she's
well, special. Here's one thing I can guarantee. Jane has been conditioned the same way you and I have.
Yeah.
This is global. This isn't something that just happens in your household and mine.
Yeah,
this is global.
Yeah, and, you know, it comes down to everything, you know, like that over the last few years I found out that my great-great-grandmother is Aboriginal. Brilliant. Now, we're not born racists. We're not born bigots. We're not born drug addicts. We're not born alcoholics. It's taught somewhere along the line. And one of the big ones that get, and it's, I don't know if it's the same over in Canada, but here, there's areas in Australia where you can go to in each state, and we call it the social security pocket, where they've lived on welfare all their lives. And the system's been taught from mother to daughter to son. You know, it's this whole cyclical thing.
That's a global thing.
Yeah.
wherever social programs are available.
Yeah, where they're taught, they're conditioned in what to do and how to get about it, you know. And it's same with these things, and it's same with life, you know. You have a look at sports people, and I spoke about this a while ago to a friend, and you know, like, there's the number one draft pick, no matter what sport, there's always this number one player. It's not him that picks to be number one, it's the club. That's the worst club picks the best player. And then if he doesn't turn out as the media wants him to be, he's belittled and then ends up with a mental illness to the point where, you know, they're suicidal. And in America, especially in NFL and baseball, there's a lot of suicides because of that pressure.
I'm in a place where I believe that the world suffers from mental illness. Seriously, we just don't talk about it.
No, and the hard thing that, I don't know if you've got the same going on over there, but they just think, the politicians think they can just throw money at it.
Well, again, and I don't want to sound like a broken record, take the title away from the politician and it's so-and-so who's grown up in a dysfunctional environment, who's looking to make better and has suffered the same way. You see, when we begin to peel the layers and we begin to peel the agendas away and we get down to the person involved, it begins to change the dynamics of the playing field.
Yeah, very true.
You know, we want people who step up to want to make a change. We want to hold them accountable for all the things that they're looking to change.
Yep.
And, you know, we put so much weight, so much emotional weight on other people. And it's typically a reflection of where we are emotionally and incapable of solving because we've been conditioned to be strong, to stay busy.
Yeah, and that's a challenge in itself. So if we look at what we've spoken about and put it into context, what would be the first step that you would say to someone to start? We'll call it the six layers of the onion from here on. The six steps. How to start pulling back and looking at different, like, life in a different light, that it's okay to feel down, but you've got to be able to tell people that you're down without the fear of repercussion. I suppose that's...
Well, you have to be willing. And that journey is different for everybody, right? And I talked about it fleetingly earlier on when somebody comes to us as the result of an event that occurs and we start peeling back layers for them and educate them that, no, you're not here seeking help because of the one incident, because your mom died or your dad died or your wife left you. We want to tie in the education that begins to introduce intangible loss, because the same emotional turmoil surfaces with intangible loss. So let's look at things in the process that we walk people through, Peter.
Yep.
We begin to plug them in to their life, and we want them to graph out their loss history. Because we understand, see, loss is cumulative, and it's cumulatively negative.
Yep.
So we take people back to dawn of conscious memory, and we have them just begin to graph out the loss events of their lives. And in my case, like, I go back to dawn of conscious memory, multiple moves So all of the emotional discomfort that surrounds those, even as a young child. But my first memory is me being tethered to a tree on King Edward, where we lived, right? It was a normal thing for parents to do.
Yeah.
And the reason I remember being tethered to that tree was because my dog was chained to the porch, and his leash was too short for him to get to me, and my tether was too short for me to get to the dog. And so there was this frustration there. Yeah. You know, do you think I realized as that child tethered to the tree trying to get to my dog that I was experiencing loss of freedom, loss of worth, loss of safety, loss of trust?
Yeah.
How could my mom have done that to me?
Yeah.
Cognitively, like I'm just not there. I'm not doing it. But on an emotional plane, it's what I was experiencing.
Yeah.
And then as you move through, like, you know, and I hope you put a link to my bio in here so the audience can go in and have a look at it. At the
Certainly
age
will.
Of seven, I tried to kill my dad.
Yeah.
Like that's an ugly story to tell, but it's an honest one and part of my life. When he disarmed me and threw me into a corner, every ounce of worth that could have lived in a little seven-year-old body seeped from me.
Yeah.
And I've been chasing self-worth my entire life. And not from a healthy perspective, Pete.
No.
Because I didn't know how to do that.
Yeah.
I seek self-worth by helping other people to a fault.
Yeah.
Where I deplete self completely because why? Replace that loss with someone else feeling good.
Yeah.
And we need to learn to self-care. And when we begin to really address some of the actual emotion and the feelings that we experience, that's when we begin to experience self-worth. And that's where we begin to experience healthy behaviors and setting boundaries, and anything else, it falls short of that. And when we do things to experience self-worth by helping somebody else, there's a degree of that. But when that's where you find all of your goodness. So I don't want to go down a rabbit trail here,
yep.
but I want to tie that back into the loss history graph. At the yep. age of seven, trying to kill my dad, all loss of self-worth, that's an intangible loss. That's not visible. Nobody sees that, but it's something I experienced. And then as a result of that, moving in with my grandparents, when they picked us up at the flat and drove us away, my grandfather drove us away, I was sitting in the seat with my brother on one side, my sister on the other, looking back at the open door of the flat we lived in, and that was the last time I was ever to live with my parents.
Yeah.
So my loss of safety right there. And so you see, my graph isn't just all about death and losing people. No, it's about all of the emotional angst I experienced in the way of intangible loss.
Yeah.
So when you begin educating people on that front, and they look at their lives based on loss, it's sobering. But here's the good news. The whole first part of our process is exploratory, and we do that. And that's uncomfortable for so many people,
yeah.
Pete.
Yeah, and that's the hard part. You know, like being where I've been, that was feeling comfortable to be uncomfortable.
Yeah, I that's a great way of saying it.
Yeah.
A great way of saying it.
Yeah, and that's when, you know, like I still know I've got a long way to go, but the journey's not scary anymore.
Well, we take it one step at a time.
Yeah.
And you see, when you understand that there's a process available for you to walk through that discomfort, for you to come to terms with the loss in your life, because, you know, as I was saying, the first, you know, sessions are exploratory, where we introduce the myths, and we want people to understand why they're in the situations they're in. And it's not their fault. It's conditioning that we've been subjected to. Yeah. And then we have them look at some of the SERBs, the short-term energy-relieving behaviors that they take on. Some of it shows up in feeding disorders. Some of it shows up in this just incredible capacity to get lost in books and reading and movies and television and gyms. And, you know, some people take up running and the world looks at them and says, oh, geez, like, you know, they've got this gym membership. Like, they go to the gym, you know, religiously, and they're not going to the gym because they're concerned about physical toning. They're going to the gym because it's a way for them to bury the pain and not have to deal with the emotional angst that's surfacing.
Yeah, and, you know, I know it's been there for forever and a day, but it just seems to be more and more now. That we're lost.
Well, it's become undeniable.
Yeah.
You know, look at mental illness has been around forever, just not in the amounts that it's showing up in now, because there's no place left for it to go.
Yeah.
More and more people are becoming aware of it. More and more people are finding themselves in situations where it has become undeniable.
Yeah.
You know, and we've been so skilled at dodging and stepping away from emotional angst that we continue to suffer in it. And how's it manifesting? It's manifesting in suicides. It's manifesting in wars. It's manifesting in division. Yep. It's manifesting in all kinds of ways that we believe are unmanageable. And I'm here to tell the audience that that's a lie.
Yeah,
it's all manageable. And it starts with people having the courage to raise their hands. You know, I'm part of an incredible project right now called the Dare to Be Vulnerable Project. Yep. And it's all around really addressing the stigma that surrounds mental illness. You know, I talked about it at the beginning of your show.
Yep.
Where we want to talk about mental health. That's a nice, neat, compartmentalized feeling, like mental health. Every time you mention health, it's a good thing,
yep.
Right? And that's the destination. That's the easy stuff to talk about. We need all the ugly stories about the unhealth,
yep.
About the illness that people have faced and people have moved through. Why? Because they took the steps to address it. They stood up. They were uncomfortable in front of their peers, in front of their siblings, in front of their families, and talked about suicidal ideation. They've yeah. talked about anxiety. They've talked about depression. They've talked about all of the things that get wrapped into the mental illness realm.
Yep.
And those are the things.
I think that's got to be, you know, like I love talking to you because I'll be awake until 1 o'clock. Thinking about the things that we've spoken about, but the big one is that it's not mental health. It is mental illness. You are ill.
Absolutely.
You are ill. It's just that it's not a gaping wound or a broken bone or a, you know, patch on an eye or it's like Jane's a good example when she went through bowel cancer and everybody goes, oh, you look so well, you'll be fine. Well, it was stage 3 bowel cancer. You're not going to, it's, you know, not 50-50. And she was
And let me ask you a question, Pete.
Yep.
When you were experiencing that, what were your friends telling you? Be strong, Pete.
Yeah, you got to be strong for Jane. You know, you got to be there for her.
And How crippling. You turn to somebody with the desire to share that pain, and the first thing out of their mouths is, be strong, Pete. Yeah. Be strong for Jane. Yeah. How cruel is that conditioning?
It's
not helping Jane. It's not helping you.
No. I think the best thing I said to Jane, this is your illness. You tell me how you want to deal with it. And we will go down whatever path you wish to take, because you're the one that's got to live with it. I've just got to support you along the way in how you want to live with it. And I think that got us through a fair bit, that she knew that whatever decision she made, like she was going to work with a chemo bottle on because that's what she wanted to do, because she thought if she stayed at home, it would beat her. And I can remember a mum was going off a bit, and I said, no, this is what she wants to do. We can't stop her trying to be as positive as she can.
Yeah. You know, I think often we aren't equipped. We don't have the words to make anybody feel anything. What we do have is the capacity and the ability to simply walk the path with them.
Yep.
Just be there. We don't have any magic words we can say to people. In fact, if we don't say anything at all, other than like, I'll walk this out with you, much what you did to Jane, you know, you just said, look, I'm going to support you in whatever decision you make to deal with this. And that's an open statement, because you don't know where she is emotionally. You don't know where she is psychologically with all of that, you know? But I'm a firm believer, and I watched my mother do this. Some people get diagnosed with the cancer and die from it.
Yep.
While others get diagnosed with the cancer and live with it.
Yep.
It sounds ridiculous, but I think it's the support mechanisms that are in place. People who are surrounded by others who are well-meaning.
Yep.
By, you know, oh, don't feel bad. Like, what is it that we don't want people to feel bad? What's wrong with feeling bad? Because it makes us uncomfortable. So we don't want them to feel bad, because it's really a reflection of our lives and where we're at and what's unfolding in us. So when people are going through things and we can simply be there for them, simply be that safe space for them to talk about things, for them to express, and not push conditioning at them. You know, most people have an aversion to going to funeral parlors, and it'll be the same story every time. I don't know what to say, and that makes me really uncomfortable, so I'm not going to go. And here's a key for everybody who's listening right now.
Yep.
Go to a funeral parlor the next time one of your friends loses somebody precious to them. Just tell them that you're sorry they're experiencing that pain, and you're there. If you're there simply to accompany them through this difficult journey. You don't have to say anything to anybody. Simply show up.
Yeah, and that's like innocent, really, isn't it? Just show up. Be your authentic self.
Be there.
Yeah. And, you know, just knowing that someone's there and, okay, they've taken the time. That's all it is, you know, like, as I said in the sometimes you hit rock bottom, and it's to do with the mental illness side of things. Everybody's prepared to say, give me a call if you're feeling bad. But how many people called me to see how I was? None.
How unfair is that, to put that weight on somebody because they won't do it?
No, not a chance in hell.
They won't do it.
Not a chance in hell that you'll sit there and go, oh, geez, I'm rock bottom. I've got to call someone. And the things that go through your head that you don't want to put a burden on their shoulders.
You know, if your audience hasn't seen that clip, make sure that it's available to them, Pete, because you shared something in that story that impacted me on a deep, deep level. And it's regarding the very element that you're talking about right now. When we do share our discomfort and people say, I'm here for you, call me if you need anything, how cruel and unfair that is. Because if you reach out to ask somebody how they're doing and they share that they're struggling,
Yep.
Here's the term you use that I absolutely loved. You've entered a social contract, and it's your responsibility as a caring friend to reach out. not put the onus on someone you know who is suffering from either emotional or physical angst to reach out to you when you need something, because odds are they'll never do it. You'll read about their demise. You'll read about them having committed suicide. You'll read about them dying of the disease and wonder why they never reached out to you. They have so much going on that front. So thank you for that, because it raised an awareness in me, right? Like that social contract.
And that's what
when you reach out. Yeah. When you reach out and you ask somebody how they're doing, it better be from a place of a genuineness.
Yeah. And that's the thing that, you know, like, to be honest, I was struggling a bit when you came to visit, but I got extremely worse after that. And I was watching all of the, you know, Are You Okay? And all the different organisations that, and this is the flip side to it, that promote to help people with mental health, to try to give them the tools to help someone with mental health. But nowhere did they talk about the consequence. And that's where I come up with the idea that if you ask someone how they're going, that's the social contract.
Yeah, no, that's powerful.
Because
that's powerful.
Yeah, because there's two scenarios that are going to happen, and you touched on one of them. And one of them is going to the funeral parlour that they don't want to go to. And the other one is being the person opens up to you. And when they open up to you, are you prepared to listen unconditionally without voicing an opinion? And this is the other one that people do say to you, and that is, well, that's stupid that you think that way. Cop that one when you're suffering from mental illness. Mm-hmm. Being told that, you know, because you're opening up and you're feeling bad and you're feeling down and you feel like that you want to take your own life, that you're stupid. So what that does is that just pushes that person aside. You don't say anything, you just push that person aside, but you just go backwards at a rate of knots. You know?
And, absolutely.
And the periods of loss and frustration that you were talking about, where, you know, your father called you stupid. So you go back into that pocket again. And you just get, it's like a hamster on a reel with some people, that they don't understand that the depths of despair that people are at when they're at rock bottom. So
you see, we get anchored to pain. Yep. We get anchored to pain every time there's an incident. And, you know, here's six little words for the audience to write down.
Yep.
Different, better, more. Hopes, dreams, and expectations. Those are the elements where we're anchored to pain events in our lives because we are incomplete emotionally.
Yeah.
And what I love about our process is that's the destination for us. We prepare people to complete emotionally. And that's where we get to pull those little hooks out of the soft spots of our spirit, but we need the courage to be able to talk about them. And, you know, you said something critical. You said something important. Our job is to simply listen. In our profession as grief and loss specialists, we refer to ourselves as hearts with ears.
Yeah, you know, like the famous saying, God gave us two of these, and one of them.
Yeah. We don't analyze, we don't judge, and we don't criticize. Yeah.
Well, Don, let's come to that time.
Wow.
I've got a timer here and I know how long we've been ticking along for. And for you to give me your time and thoughts and understanding, like we could go for, I could do a Joe Rogan on this with you. You know, go for three, 4 hours. But, you know, I've got to be fair here. But we can have more episodes of
absolutely, absolutely. I love that, Pete.
First of all, how would someone get in contact with you if they felt that they connected with you in this conversation and that they feel that they could go down the path that you take people?
This is ironic, right? Because I poo-poo the social media platforms, but it's the easiest way for people to connect.
Yep.
You know, I can be found at on Facebook at dvlachance.com. That's the link to my bio.
Yep.
Facebook is, if you just do a search on loss specialist,
yeah,
I can provide you with the links if you want to put them.
I'll have the links. I've got them in your bio and everything like that. But the main one for me for people to go to is dvlachance.com.
Absolutely. And because my bio is there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm raw in it, Pete.
Yeah.
You know, our motto is we go first.
Yep. And, you know, it's just like the sometimes you hit rock bottom. You know, I was going to edit it and I started listening to it and I said, nah, I can't edit this. I just got to let it go as raw as it's got to be, because we talk about turning up and being your authentic self. And if you're editing things, you're not authentic. That's how I see it. It's,
yeah, ego's taken over.
Yeah, yeah. So when I do these shows, and once again, I appreciate your time, these just go out. I just polish up the sound to make sure it sounds good, but they just go out and be as raw as they can with me scratching and carrying on and the sniffles and things like that. But
yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, because those are the things we hope resonate with people, right? Like, this is real.
Yeah.
This is real. There's, you know, we show up without armor.
And that's what I want people to start to get from these podcasts and episodes and things like that. That it's two things. One is it's okay to be broken, right? That, you know, everything in the world breaks and we're included in that, whether it's physical or mental. And the other thing is that it's okay to be yourself. Not what others want you to be, but who you wish to be.
Your authentic self.
Yeah. And that's one of the things I close off sometimes with, you know, the show is the Peter George Experience, success through conversation and experiences, but it's really to help you be the best you can be.
That's awesome, Pete. Yeah. I just want you to know that I'll support you on this journey any way I can.
Yeah, and, you know, like, I hope people reach out to you because you just know at the right point to get that little bit extra from someone that will hopefully open them up, like that young girl did at the hospital where she went through the circle of who Peter George was. And that's when I realised that pain was just another little dot on the journey of Peter George. And it took her to do it. You know, like I knew I probably could have come to you, but I didn't feel that it was right. But, you know, as I said, going to the hospital and things like that, the mental health unit scared the bejeevers out of me with the people that were in there and what they're going through. And then two, the team that they put you in touch with was phenomenal. So there is help there for people and you just got to find it. And on, in a couple of weeks' time, I'm talking with a guy called David McBride. Now, Dave was part of my recovery. And as I say in the talk, that he didn't do much, but he was there for me. And that's what it all comes down to.
Yeah.
You know, like, he turned up, which I never used to, and that's how you can pick someone with mental illness. They don't start turning up. But he turned up here, didn't judge, just listened. So, and you do the same thing, my good friend, and you know, we owe a lot to you as a person.
Thank you, Peter.
Pleasure. So, once again, I know we waffled on about the pats on the back, but no, Don deserves one, and we hope you enjoyed this show. Shows are out every Wednesday at a stupid time. I put them out there at 5 o'clock now in the morning so people can get into them on the way to work. So, once again, Don, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you on the Peter George Experience.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you for the work you're doing. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you. Beautiful. It's
better over here. After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/AcrossAmerica.
Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device, credit, service, ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with autopay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without autopay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.